Okay, so I'm going to talk about microlensing from solar system spacecraft. And so I mentioned in my earlier talk that the original goal of microlensing was searching for dark matter. We found something that potentially could be a little bit of the dark matter in the Large Magellanic Cloud, but this is not the prime issue anymore for microlensing searches. So now the main issue is searching for extrasolar planets. So I'll talk a little bit about that. So this slide's supposed to show the basic physics of microlensing. So we make use of two stars. There's a background star, which basically acts like a source of light. And then we're studying the lens object, a lens star, and then its planet, if it has one. And so this is a method actually, it's a method that it allows us to detect planets orbiting stars that we don't, the stars we don't actually detect, because the light we're seeing is actually from a background star. It also gives, this sort of shows what happens most of the time, even when you have a system with a planet, you don't see any signal from the planet. You see lensing just by the star, and this gives rise to two images. We call this microlensing, though, because those two images are separated by an angle too small to see. These can get actually quite bright. But then we look for special cases where one of these two images that's lensed by the star is also lensed by the planet, and then we see an additional effect there. And the amplitude of that effect can be quite large. But the thing is that it's with this gravitational lensing, these alignments we need are rare, and they don't last for a real long time. So the challenge is to observe enough stars to see these effects rather than to see a very tiny effect. And a key fact here that makes it interesting for searching for planets is that the geometric mean of the distance to the galactic center and the Schwarzschild radius of the sun is about an AU. Okay, and this is actually this is the separation of these light rays as they pass the star is typically a few AU, and that's where we're sensitive to planets. And because this alignment that we're looking for is so rare, we need to look where there's the best chance of alignment, and that's toward the center of our galaxy. And we win twice by looking to the center of our galaxy. One is it's a large density of source stars, and two, there's a large density of potential lenses. And so basically, the probability of seeing lensing goes sort of as a square of the stellar density, because you need both lenses and sources. We tend to be studying stars that are not TPF targets. They tend to be thousands of parsecs from the sun, but we can also look at the distribution of planets as a function of position in the galaxy. This is a simulated light curve of actually the first event found by a planet. This is what it looks like from a ground-based observation, and so it's basically this this time history, these two flashes here that we're seeing. That's the signal that we're detecting. It's similar to transits. It's just changes in photometry over time. This is now a magnified version of the same event, now showing what the actual images look like. This is at microarc second resolution. So when you have the planet, when you have the telescope that that can see continents on an extrasolar planet, you could look at a microlensing event and see this. And so this is the location of the star. This is a so-called Einstein ring, which is just a location of the ring image if you had perfect alignment between the star and the lens. And then, this is a lens star, and then this blue thing is a location of the background star. But of course, you don't see that because the light has to propagate in the real gravitational field of the star and its planet. And so these purple things are these are the images. And so there's two images at first, and then one of those images approaches a planet, and we see multiple images being created and destroyed there. And it's these flashes in the previous slide were in the previous video were these Coster crossing features, where if you had a point source, you'd actually for an instant have images that were infinitely bright. But instead, they resolve the finite size of the source star. And so these sort of sharp features are typical. So here's the this is the first low mass planet found by gravitational microlensing. It has sort of here's the magnification. This is in linear units. Reached a magnification of 3. This is a giant source star. Then there was a little bump on the light curve when it got to low mass. And this is from when it got to lower magnification. And this was from a planet of about 5.5 Earth masses. This is actually close to the lower limit of the mass of a planet we could detect for this source star. This is a giant source star. And as you'll see in a second, the star only, the planet actually only has a big enough gravitational field to lens part of the star. Okay, so here's a video that's similar to the previous one I showed, but now because the planet's smaller, there's the two images, one on the top and one on the bottom. We focus in on this one just before it approaches the planet. Now we're here, the planet is coming in here near this thing, but this is not the planet. That's just an image that's located close to it. So the the planet sort of crosses across the face of the star. This is not really the star. That's the image that you would see just due to lensing by the star. So there's these two images are both elongated. That's due to lensing by the star. And then this image gets approached by the planet. And then you see this sort of characteristic feature when it's crossing an Einstein ring where you get multiple images of the star sort of making a little ring, and inside the ring is the location of the planet. Now this is just a comparison of the two, of the same video I showed compared to what happened if you had, instead of a 5.5 Earth mass planet, a 16.5 Earth mass planet. And so basically the thing is different. It's just that, you know, gravitational field's bigger, and so the bending angle due to gravity is larger, and so this makes, you know, a larger angular effect. Okay, so but what we, of course, what we see is not anything as detailed as this. We just see the total change in flux, and so this is big enough so that so we're still seeing some significant change in flux. We see a much bigger change in flux here, but if the planet were 5 times smaller, then the change in flux would be down around 1%, and it'd be pretty challenging to detect. Okay, so for lower mass planets, we tend to use smaller angular size source stars, main sequence stars instead of giants. And so one of the ways we do that is to look for very high magnification events. And here the signal is somewhat different. For high magnification, this is an event with a magnification of 800. Just due to the star, and what's happened is just that you get extremely good alignment between the foreground and the background stars, and you get almost the perfect case where you have this so-called Einstein ring image, where we have perfect alignment, and then by symmetry you have to have a ring image. And so in here, the signal of the planet is a little bit different. It's just distorting the symmetry and breaking the Einstein ring, and so it's a little bit hard to see the signal here because the on this light curve plot, because the magnification is changing so rapidly due to the fact that the alignment is only good for a very short amount of time. But if you divide by the single lens curve, you see this feature here, and sort of half the feature is caught by observation by the MDM telescope that had I think they took observations every 10 seconds. And so we could map out this characteristic sort of caustic crossing feature here. So this is the second sort of low mass sub-Neptune mass planet found by microlensing. Okay. So in comparison to other techniques, this is a plot that's supposed to show, as of a few months ago probably, the locations of all the reported exoplanet detections by category. These upside down T's are the radial velocity detections, with the bottom of the T is their mass if they're, you're seeing it in the orbital plane, and they have an error bar in one direction depending on their, due to the unknown inclination. These are transit discoveries here, and I've sorted the radial velocity in transits depending on which signal came first. If they saw a transit first, then I call it a transit discovery. If they detected the radial velocity in a transit later, then it's a radial velocity discovery. So microlensing fills this region here. And so basically, we're seeing planets that are sort of in 10-year orbits. They're a lot colder than the low-mass planets that are found in other techniques. We overlap with radial velocity sensitivity at in the giant planet range, but we're uniquely sensitive, at least among operating techniques, we're uniquely sensitive to low-mass planets out beyond 1 AU. These are the direct detection planets up here. Timing detections here, and the lowest mass planet is orbiting a pulsar. It's down here. Now, one thing I want to talk about, you notice that the microlensing detections have different symbols here. And this has to do with the bit I mentioned earlier, that we can detect planets orbiting stars that we don't see. And when we don't see them, we often don't have that much information about their properties. We can make some estimates, but these ones with the circles are the ones where we don't have a direct measure of the star's properties, and so there's some uncertainty in the masses there. Whereas these ones with the solid dots, those are ones where we have measured properties. In one case, we can measure the properties of the star reasonably well, but the light curve wasn't measured that precisely, so there's still a fair lot of uncertainty in the planet. Okay, and so this is actually the area where the solar system observations can contribute. I should say that this is now the same plot on perhaps a more physically relevant graph, because the previous plot showed things as a function of AU, but you know, we're comparing the planets orbiting most of the stars. The planets found by microlensing tend to be orbiting M dwarfs. You know, a planet orbiting an M dwarf at 1 AU is a little bit different than a planet orbiting a G star at 1 AU. The temperature region is quite a bit different. And here, we've compared them to the temperature at the time of formation, so the snow line. And we see that basically we're finding low mass planets that are outside the snow line. And in fact, we think that the planets we're finding are actually substantially more common than the ones that are seen so far by other techniques. And statistical analysis show this. If we compare to the radial velocities, we're sort of consistent with the power law they see, but we see, we're making this measurement out here beyond the snow line. And then as a function of mass, the microlensing measurement here, we see, that we're rising to very small masses. Maybe not all the way down to an Earth mass, but we see that these outer planets are more common even than the claims, the measurements that Mayor et al. make at 50-day periods or less. Okay, so based on a handful of detections so far, it looks like that these things are pretty common. What we'd like to do is to understand this a little bit better, to understand our sample better. To see whether there's a gradient in the planet properties as a function of position in the galaxy, to see how they depend on the mass of the host. We really need to know more about the mass of the host stars. And so so while we're sensitive to planetary masses, in order to actually measure the mass, we need to get more information on the geometry of the system than we just see the lensing event. Because we can describe the lensing event, we can sort of scale out this Einstein radius and describe everything in terms of the Einstein radius, but then we lose physical information that we'd like to know, like the mass and the distance to the lens system. So the way we try and figure this out is by getting more information. So this is a case where you have this Einstein ring lens perfectly along the line of sight. Then you get this this ring image at the Einstein radius. And what we'd like to do, we can often do, is measure the two projections of this Einstein radius, either the angular Einstein radius, so that the size of the Einstein ring seen as an angle in the sky. This is something that we get almost all the time for a planetary event, just because the features in the planetary event resolve the finite angular size of the source star. We can estimate the finite angular size of the source star to a few percent by its infrared and optical colors. And so we can get that pretty well. The thing that we need the solar system probes to do is to do this other projection. And this is to measure the projected Einstein radius in at the position of the observer. Okay, this is what we call microlensing parallax. And basically, because these Einstein radii are a few AU, if we have another observer that's a few AU away, they're going to see a microlensing light curve that looks very different. Just sort of stereoscopic vision we're looking at lensing events, so they're a little bit more complicated. But in fact, if you just go through the algebra here, you see if you measure both these projections of the Einstein ring, you uniquely get the mass. Okay, and so there's three ways to do this. One way is the very first way that ordinary parallax was actually used is to measure, say, the distance between the sun and the moon to do observations at different locations. In microlensing, this is rarely a large enough distance to be effective, but there's at least one case in which the features are so sharp and the magnification is very high that we can measure this effect, different light curves from different observatories on Earth. The most common thing is to use the orbital motion of the Earth, the same way that ordinary parallax is usually measured. And then finally, the most interest here is from satellite far from the Earth. This has been done a couple of times. There's Ogle 2005 SMC1, an event in the Small Magellanic Cloud that was observed by Spitzer. And then we haven't completed the analysis, but this one microlensing event that occurred last September was observed by Epoxy. And we think that this should give us a precise mass measurement for the star and the planet for this event. So this is just a slide for this one terrestrial parallax measurement that's been published. There's three observatories here, one in the Canaries, one in someone's backyard in Pretoria, and one in Chile. And because this magnification is very high, this is not magnitudes, but log of magnification. So this is about a factor of 2600. So there's different light curves from the different locations, and this allowed us to conclude that the lens here is a brown dwarf, 500 parsecs away. Okay. The best measured planetary event with orbital parallax is this double planet event. It's the most complicated event that we've seen. It's got signals from two planets. I'm not going to go into detail about this, but there's like five different features. There's four features due to a Saturn mass planet that happens to be very close to the Einstein ring, and an additional feature that's due to another planet further from the Einstein ring. This is actually sort of a Jupiter-Saturn analog system. In that previous movie, I showed that we see these features basically when the source star is crossing a caustic. Well, this event is fairly complicated. We see effects of the caustics changing due to the orbital motion of the planet. In fact, we get relative astrometry between the star and the planet at the pico arcsecond level, and allows us to tell us how fast, basically how fast the planet's moving. But we also see this curved trajectory here. That's due to the orbital motion of the Earth. And so basically, because this event has all these very sharp features, we get good timings on these things. And this allows us to measure both the orbital motion and the parallax. There is actually a little bit of degeneracy between those two parameters. So the source is actually quite faint. This is a ground-based color magnitude diagram, so we couldn't resolve the source star from ordinary ground-based data. And there's another object that's a lot brighter, very close to the source, that's right there on the color magnitude diagram. If we look here, this is a blown up one of our ground-based images from the Ogle telescope. But if we look in the H-band from Keck with AO, we see that it's offset by a third of an arc second from that. And we look at the brightness of this thing, it's six times brighter than we expect, than the measurement of the source star is. And this, in fact, means that the lens star is five times brighter than the source in H-band. And in fact, it turns out to have exactly the brightness we expect from the mass that we determined, from the light curve model. So we got this with a large error bar, half a solar mass with a larger error bar to larger masses due to this degeneracy. And we get this combining the photometry and the Keck imaging and the light curve analysis. Okay, so the next event with the one with the satellite measurement is this one. The analysis of this one isn't really complete. This was an event observed in the MOA survey. They noticed this planetary signal, alerted all these other telescopes, and we have pretty complete coverage then after the planetary signal was noticed. And so we contacted the epoxy folks after a few days after we noticed the planetary signal. They thought it was interesting and tried to get some observations. Those observations got canceled because of anomaly, but then they realized they had to do calibration tests, and our field was a better calibrating field than the one they had originally planned. So Andy Becker is going to they're going to talk more about the data here. So now, just to finish off, I wanted to talk a little bit about the sort of requirements here. So we need to observe these. We have sort of tighter time requirements than other sort of observations might do. We need to observe the host star during the stellar part of the lensing event, because we want to see the evolution of the lensing event. If we come back a year later, we can't say, well, if we know that, like the transits, they know that their transits are happening regularly, so they can schedule long ahead of time. We can't. But we do know that all of our targets are in pretty much the same location of the sky. So conceivably, we could schedule observations in this location of the sky and then feed the exact coordinates just before the observations. The optimum Earth satellite separation is a few times smaller than this Einstein ring radius. There's different classes of events, long events last month, short events 1 to 2 weeks. And the targets are faint compared to sort of transiting stars. These are quite bright to sort of extragalactic observers, but they're pretty faint for solar system observations and for transits. And we have low precision requirements compared to transits. All right, so long events, these are typically caused by planetary host stars in a galactic disk or ones that have high mass, where high mass is bigger than a third of a solar mass. Many of these have partial measurements due to the orbital motion of the Earth, but oftentimes we're left with some ambiguity in the modeling, and so a few observations from a satellite can usually remove that ambiguity. And this one event that we have observed is an example of this. We got the observations about a month after the planetary signal. And this is best observed by a satellite that's not that far away from the Earth, or is in the foreground of the, I mean, between us and the galactic bulge, as Cassini will be toward the end of its extended mission. Mars missions would also be good for that. But perhaps a more interesting possibility, although more challenging in terms of the time scale, these shorter events. The shorter events tend to be ones where the lenses are in the galactic bulge. And so the projected Einstein radius just from the projection effect is much larger. So then we need a larger separation to see it, to see the signals. Projected Einstein radii between 10 to 30 AU. And so this is another thing that would be good for Cassini. And here we typically have no signal from the ground, that the parallax effects to see from the ground are too small. The orbital motion of the Earth over a few weeks is not very large. And so, you know, this would be sort of the most challenging, but we'd be getting measurements where we otherwise have very little information and basically understanding planets in the galactic bulge. Okay, that's all I wanted to cover. Questions? Yeah. Oh, you should use the microphone.
Is there any advantage in having really high spatial resolution for you? Because you guys don't want to defocus or anything, but I mean, is there any chance of resolving the lens star if you're out in space? And then
we'll see from Andy's talk that there is an advantage to having the telescope in focus, and because you know we are looking in fairly crowded fields, you know, there would be if we get angular resolution comparable to HST or ground-based AO, that would be helpful for separating out the lens and potential lens and source stars, which would still be unresolved, separating out those from the neighboring stars. But that's not something we anticipate doing from solar system missions. I mean, the large telescopes we'd use for that would be, you know, AO systems on the ground, HST, JWST, or whatever. Charlie, why don't you pass the mic over?
For microlensing parallax is, I guess, adding the second spacecraft to get one parallax is very helpful. Does it help to add another spacecraft?
Yeah, so it often does. There are potential degeneracies in the light curves. You can have typically the parallax you measure is sort of a two-dimensional vector. The orientation. It was a two-dimensional vector, and typically there are some degeneracies where you have two sets of parameters that give you a very similar looking light curve. And typically it will look similar from the Earth and the satellite, and then if you have another satellite, it'll look completely different from that other satellite. Sometimes that's not interesting though, that the two solutions will have nearly identical parameters and you'll be learning things that aren't physically interesting. And also it makes a difference what the, and not just the position of the satellites, but their relative velocities. So usually if you have one satellite, you can make do with a lot of observations from that one satellite and get the information that you would get from the second satellite. But with the second satellite, you can get this information in a lot, with a lot sparser observations. And so sometimes, you know, that may be a better option for many cases.
Just to follow up on Nick's question about pixel size, do you have a sense where you fall off a cliff for your crowded fields? What angular resolution? Is it, you know, 1, 10 arcseconds?
I think, you know, 10 arcseconds would generally be fairly difficult. As we'll see, the epoxy images are 4 arcseconds wide. Certainly not a problem with giant stars, and probably if we had a lot of observations, we could probably make do with very poor with very poor angular resolution. The thing is that if we had the thing that would help if we had bad angular resolution is to be able to get a lot of observations and to get them quickly, because oftentimes these events reach pretty high magnification, and so if you get them with bad angular resolution but at high magnification, then you still get a fairly strong signal. And in fact, a lot of the ground-based discoveries are made by amateurs, or a lot of the data that contribute to these discoveries. They look at these high magnification events. They have the advantage that no one else ever uses their telescopes, and so they can observe at exactly the right time, and they help out with a lot of discoveries. Charlie?
So if you have not resolved well enough the object that's being lensed, but it's blended with something that's fairly close by, can you do a higher resolution observation with a different instrument on a different day and resolve some of that ambiguity?
Well, generally, we can work out how bright the source star is just from the light curve. In the example I showed, we knew how bright the source star was, even though it's 5 times fainter than the lens star and 50 times fainter than this other star, a third of an arcsecond away. So generally, the higher resolution is to separate the source and the lens from any neighboring star. So, but if we have the good parallax measurements, we actually measure the mass without ever resolving the lens star. So conceivably, we could still be confused between, you know, a white dwarf host and an M dwarf host if we don't see light from either one. But in general, you know, we can get the mass pretty accurately without resolving the source star.
Can I add something to the mantle? Yes, you can definitely.
Yes. So you can definitely use ground-based images to constrain the positions of stars in these poorly focused or highly deblended images. And essentially use the ground-based data as constraints on deblending in the space-based epoxy data. So I think that's something we plan on doing with these data as well.
Okay, no more questions, and it's time for Andy's talk.
Yeah, I have a question about
the probability of lensing events in the Kepler field. So the biggest probability is lensing by white dwarf companions to the Kepler stars. And in fact, this was originally a concern of the Kepler team that white dwarfs are the same size as Earth's. And they might be a little bit, typically a little bit hotter than the stars they would orbit. And so you might have an signal, photometric signal that looks quite similar when the white dwarf goes behind the star. But fortunately, then the white dwarf is going to come in front of the star, and the lensing signal is much stronger than the transit signal. It's quite small by the standards of events we look at, but it's much larger than the transit signal. That's how they exclude this potential background of white dwarf transits. Actual lensing of stars in the Kepler field by unrelated stars. I think the probability there is a little bit less than 10 to the minus 8, which is down by more than a factor of 100 from the galactic bulge stars. There was, however, one microlensing event observed by an amateur in Japan who looks for comets and nova with binoculars, and he found a microlensing event, and we estimated that if he searched half the sky available to him every night for 30 years and it was clear all the time, that he might see another event. And in fact, apparently he's been observing for about 40 years, so. Yeah, and he's discovered sort of more, he's a lot more discoveries than most professional astronomers, by quite a large amount.